Well, welcome and thanks for hanging out for a little while, talking about these interwoven themes of technology, parenting, childhood development, family development, and so on. Before we dive in, I think it's important to say a couple of things. Let's first talk about why you're here. I assume that you came either because you're thinking of becoming a parent, you already are a parent, or you're a parent and the other person you parent with forced you to come because you disagree about technology use. You know, it used to be that finances were the item that couples argued about the most. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think now it's tech use. Because we're worried about it. We're anxious about all this very rapid spread of technology into our lives just in the last few years and the ways in which our kids are growing up in environments where technology is everywhere, and we really don't have a handle yet on how best to navigate this new landscape. So I want to talk about this a little bit tonight and to do two things, really. One is to have an opportunity to share some of the theoretical and research-based stuff that's out there around the interface between child and youth development and technologies. So in a general way, to get you thinking about guiding principles in working with technology and with youth development, childhood development, so that even if you don't get a very practical notion around a given area of technologies, you have a way of thinking about it. The second thing is to give you some practical suggestions and ideas. Now, before I do all that, I'm tempted to say that if I do my job properly tonight, I will make you uncomfortable. This is a troubling issue, the imbalance we now face with technology use. Most people are worried about this in a big way with their families, don't really know what to do about it, are trying to handle it in the best way they know how, and are not handling it very well. So a big chunk of what I talk about tonight may make you uncomfortable, and I just encourage you to be aware of your own reactivity to some of the things I might say. So if I put something up here or I say something that makes you think about your own parenting style or something that happens in your family, just notice your reaction to it and try to be mindful about the fact that we get reactive as parents about lots of different things. Parents are an interesting group because all parents are trying to do a good job, pretty much, with their kids. Most parents believe they're doing a great job with their kids, and most parents are wrong. You know, really, I mean, we kind of pull it all together as much as we can as parents, but I think most parents recognize that we do drop the ball in a bunch of different areas, and that's human nature. We're not perfect. So we shouldn't have perfection as our ideal here. We should be always thinking about how we might improve in incremental ways. And that's something I will say repeatedly tonight. The solution to the technology problem is incremental steps. It's not about transforming your whole lifestyle or removing all computers from your house or doing anything radical like that. It's about trying a bunch of different things, different little interventions, and seeing which ones work best. So that's the attitude basically that I'm going to take tonight, is that this is complex. It's potentially transformative, but only in ways that allow us to make small movements rather than big ones. Okay, so the first thing is that the technology issue is interwoven with everything else in our lives at the moment. There's a whole bunch of complexity to this, and we can't really separate technology from culture, from the economics of our current landscape, from childhood development, from education. All these aspects of our environment are deeply influenced by technology. And so this is very, very complicated. And I'm going to try to kind of weave my way through this in the best way that makes sense to me so that you get greater awareness by the end of tonight. You get some sense of how you might tweak a few things in your life, how you might think more broadly about dealing with technology in your family or with your kids, and that you get some direction for practical interventions you might make that are small. As I said a moment ago, making small interventions is the solution because it's not clear that big interventions really work with technology. A lot of it's small stuff, and the research bears that out, as we'll see. So where I'm going to start is with something very old and something very important, which is the relationship between the history of human culture and the human animal and the development of an individual. So, and I'm also going to start with little kids and move my way up. So I'm going to do a thing here where I'm going to walk back and forth a lot. I'm going to put birth about here, and I'm going to put adulthood about here. Now, when people think about adulthood, they think about kids of 19, 20, 21, but that's not adulthood. The average age of final move out for kids in Canada these days is age 31. So, if you have like kids 18, 19, 20, just forget about that TV room, that quilting room, that home exercise room. You're not getting that for another decade. And that makes sense, frankly, because the development of young people architecturally, anatomically, in the nervous system doesn't really complete till about age 27 or so, or maybe even a bit later. So we're not really capable of being physically adult until about, 28. And then it takes you a while to figure out what you're going to do with that. And that makes sense. So we're going to put about 30 over here, which means 15 is the middle. And I should say that if you have a 15-year-old, this is the toughest age in some ways. It's interesting because, and I'll come back to this later, but there's this kind of graph that you could draw. So kids, when they're born, they have basically no authority and no autonomy. You control everything for them. And you have all of that, all the authority and all the autonomy. And as they get older, they get a little more autonomy and authority. Like when they're 6, you decide what item they can order from the kids' menu at a restaurant. You don't let them order anything from the menu, right? And they get a little older, they get a little more authority, and so you give them more and more choice, right? Meanwhile, your authority and autonomy are dropping. And eventually, these two lines cross. And where they cross is age 15. Because you can say, to a child of 15, you can say, my house, my rules. And the kid will say, okay, well, I'm going to somebody else's house then. Right? Fine. I don't care. And you can say to a child of 15, I will take away your phone. And they'll say, fine. I will buy another one. I will get a job and I'll buy. I mean, you can't win by forcing a child from 15 onward. Eventually, this graph goes like this. To the point where, they're in their 20s and they should have most of the authority and autonomy for their lives at that age, and you have less and less and less. And eventually, as you get older and they get older, by the time you get way over here, eventually they have all the authority and all the autonomy, and they will decide for you how you're going to spend your twilight years, right? So, it's like in The Lion King, right? It's the circle of life. So 15 is a tricky one, and I'll come back to age 15 because it's also the moment where technology issues often become the most challenging. But we shouldn't start there because this age 15 challenge is the result of a long sequence of events that have happened beforehand, which people often miss. So I'm going to start way back here with kids at birth. We know now an astonishing amount about the life of kids from about 0 to 4 or 5 and the kind of developmental milestones that they go through that deeply influence many, many later stages of their lives. For example, to take two common instances of this, one is with regard to attention deficit problems. We know that kids between 0 and 4 who watch television or who play on the computer or who use cell phones, who use any kind of screens. For every hour of screen time that they have between 0 and 4 every day, for every daily hour of screen time they have, that represents a 10% greater risk of developing attentional problems in high school. So if you have a child who's spending 2 or 3 hours on a computer and they're age 2 or 3 years old, that's a 20 or 30% greater risk of developing attentional problems in high school. And we have a lot of kids in Canada who are spending, 5, 6, 7 hours a day in front of screens. And so that's a 50, 60, 70% greater risk of attentional problems in high school. And this association has long been recognized. And we have this avalanche of attentional problems right now for kids in high school. And it's a good example of how this is not really about what happens in high school so much as it's about what happens in early childhood development. So the first practical tip I guess I should give at this point is that we should limit screen time for little kids. And I'll give you some numbers about that in a little bit. But just keep that in your mind, because it's a tough nut to crack for many parents who have the idea that when their child turns one, a great birthday present is an iPad. It is not. Other things we see in early childhood development and their relationship to later things are examples such as language acquisition. Kids who use language acquisition tools on the computer, like Baby Einstein, for example, which is supposed to help your kids be more literate, learn to read quicker, learn to have a larger vocabulary. Turns out that kids who use these early learning tools learn, on average, 7 fewer words per day than kids who don't use these early learning acquisition tools. So Baby Einstein makes you stupider. And yet there's this urgency and there's this sense from parents that, yes, our kids should be as exposed as early as possible to these screens because they will help them. I had a parent say to me the other night, another presentation. She said, my 18-month-old, he loves the phone. He can pick up the phone. He can do all this stuff, and he can open apps, and he can do amazing things on the phone. I'm like, yeah, awesome. Bad. Very bad. We don't know exactly why screens are bad for young kids, but the jury's not out on this one. Everybody agrees on this. Everybody who researches this agrees that we should be mindful about screen exposure for young kids, because the environment for small child development has to look a certain way in order for that development to work properly. The first thing is that little kids learn so much just by being in relationship with their parents, their caregivers, and their siblings. Here's a good example. Your average year-old child has 150 different kinds of cries. 150. Each one is a word, right? One means, give me the cat. Another means, give me a dog. Another means, I'm hungry. Another means, I'm thirsty. Another means, I'm tired. And the job of parents, which is an immensely challenging job at this age. Actually, parents of kids this age have been measured against norms for stress in other fields, going from no stress at all to the stress of the mental stress of torture. And that's where parents measure. Parents of little kids, infants. It's horribly difficult. The sleep deprivation, the stress, the anxiety. It's crazy, right? So they have 150 kinds of cries. And our job is to try to figure out what each one means. And that is very difficult. And it is much easier today to just give them a device, which will make them stop, for sure. But it's a great example of how we've kind of tweaked the cultural and evolutionary heritage of humans a little bit in the last decade or so, so that a lot of that relational time, spending time with people, communicating with people, has been reduced for little kids. The other thing that's been reduced is play with objects and in nature. Kids used to spend all their time in nature up until the last, 100 years in most cultures. And the play in nature and the play with objects is immensely important. When we look at how the human body developed through evolution, we find that changes in the hand come before changes in the brain. So the hand goes out and explores the world, explores the universe, and then feeds that information back to the brain, and the brain changes in response to the hand. So it's not that the brain is managing all this stuff. The hand is managing it all in our evolution. The hand is the driving force of human evolution. And so the hand and its involvement in the world shapes us more profoundly than anything else does. And that hand, in early childhood development, must be exposed to all kinds of environments. Hot, cold, wet, dry, rough, smooth, everything. And the amount of learning that is gleaned from that by a child is immense and long-lasting. What we've done now is we've taken a lot of that out of the equation. So a lot of kids are spending all day interacting only with plasticized or glass environments. All screens are smooth and glassy. All keyboards are plasticized. And so many of the devices that we interact with are all the same. They feel exactly the same. One is identical, explicitly and intentionally identical to another. This is a bit of a problem, a big problem for little kids who don't thrive in that kind of environment. They thrive in an environment of tactile diversity. And this is related to the leading theory about why kids who read with regular books learn faster and better than kids who read on iPads and Kindles. This is true of adults too, by the way. If you read on a Kindle as an adult, you don't retain as much as if you were to read it with a physical book. That may change over time, but that's currently the way it is. The theory about kids, little kids, is that the tactile feel of a real book has meaning. The tactile feel is about the hand's interaction with the object, which creates an enhanced learning environment as compared to a screen, which is more, it's flatter. You just touch, it's at the same Z index the whole time. You're not involved in manipulating a three-dimensional object and moving things back and forth as you are with pages. You're just clicking and hitting something. It's different. So all of this stuff about what we do with little kids is connected to the deep importance of having kids explore the world. Find out what's out there. Get themselves a little dirty and get themselves a little hurt. Something that I'm going to return to a lot tonight is this notion of risk. We live in a very risk-averse society. We don't want our kids to be hurt. I get it. As a parent myself, I can remember that experience of having my kids go to the playground when they were 2 or 3 years old and really worrying about them falling and hurting themselves, which sometimes they did, and sometimes they should. The negotiation with risk, which starts at this very early age, continues on and looks different at different ages of childhood development. Eventually it becomes serious physical risk, and then it becomes emotional risk, and then it becomes the risks of getting out into the world as an adult, as a young adult. And the ability of kids to navigate that phase, which we'll get to as we move along this continuum, the ability of kids to navigate the process of getting out into the world as adults is directly related to their exposure to healthy risk when they were 2 or 3 years old. It sets them on a path. So, a lot of this kind of stuff is very different than what a screen environment provides. In fact, you could make an argument that screen environments do not provide any of these things. They provide something that's cultivated, something that's isolated, something that's safe, something that from an object point of view is harmonious and homogeneous, and doesn't offer any real risk at all, except possibly the risk of electrocution if you drop your iPad in the bathtub. As kids get older, they move out into the world of peers. They start to build things, make things, draw things, create things. They love Lego. They love robotics. They love little machines. They love sports. They love making relationships beyond the family with friends and with allies in the school and in the community. They get more involved in grandparents, the life of grandparents and teachers, that kind of thing. Church peers, church mentors, and a whole new universe for the child opens up. And if the foundation is strong from the first 4 or 5 years, this next 5 years or so becomes another level of that deep exploration, another understanding of greater risk. You know, like kids who are 7 or 8, they'll be like, well, a kid of two, if you say, you must never stick your finger in the socket, they will go, okay, and they won't do it. A kid of 6 will go, why not? What happens if I do stick my finger in the socket? Let's try that, right? They start to explore the world in a riskier sort of manner, and they get more autonomy, they get more creativity, and they start to develop something that psychologists these days call self-regulation, but used to be called self-discipline or self-control or self-reliance. There's all kinds of terms for this. But self-regulation is a theme that I'll reinforced two or three times here. It's very important in the context of technology. Self-regulation is the ability to modulate your emotions without help from an outside influence, like a technology or a substance in the case of addictions, or some other person, or some behavior. Self-regulation is the ability, when you're driving your car in traffic, it's terrible traffic, and somebody cuts you off, self-regulation is the ability to say to yourself, do not put your foot on the accelerator and slam into them. Do not yell. Do not give them the finger. Do not do anything that will cause harm to another person. And sometimes when the traffic's really bad, you have to sit there in your car just repeating these kinds of messages to yourself on and on and on. That is self-regulation. People who fail at self-regulation in all kinds of ways get into trouble. And the avalanche of mental health difficulties we have right now and the avalanche of addictions is mostly a matter of self-regulation. And as I said, I'll particularly emphasize that in the next two bits. But it starts here between 5 and 9. So practical suggestion about technology. When your kids are 5, talk to them about technology as risk. This is a risky thing, technology. The use of technology. It's kind of like walking across the street. It's risky. You can't make it unrisky. Kids using technology could accidentally get involved in all kinds of unsafe and unhealthy things online, without even meaning to. So there's a big risk with technology. And risk and self-regulation go together. Self-regulation is partly about modulating risk. So we should let our kids know when they're quite young that there's a risk to technology, to the use of technology, and that they need to start to apply and practice some self-regulation around it. And for kids 7, 6, 7, 8, that self-regulation with regard to technology looks like the noticing of that slight computer headache that you get after 20 to 30 minutes on the computer. You know what it's like, right? You go on the computer, you go on your phone, you go whatever, and after a while, like, it's not that long. Cell phone, it's like 10 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes. Laptop, it's 10 to 15 minutes. Big screen thing, it's half an hour. Television, if you got a big television, it's a couple of hours before you get that little headache, which you ignore every time. Kids need to start to notice this little eye fatigue, this sense of driftiness, this lack of focus. Kids who are 7, 8, and 9 can do this. They can notice it. If parents train them to be aware of what happens to your body when you sit still staring at a screen for 20 or 30 minutes. When they get to age 11 and 12, they stop noticing it because other things become more important. So if you have little kids and you can start early with technology, talk to them about this. Educate them about this in the same way that you educate them about crossing the street or washing your hands or eating safe food or not talking to strangers, things like that. This technology risk aspect should be part of childhood development education by parents starting around age 5, 6. Okay. And then adolescents move on to this world of stress. The adolescent period is the most stressful period of human life. Nothing is more stressful than adolescence, which is kind of scary. One of the reasons it's complicated and stressful has to do with an interesting neurological phase that kids go through where they recapitulate earlier developmental themes. So, let's say that when you were 4 or 5, one of your parents got really ill and everyone thought they were going to die and they didn't, but it was very upsetting for some long period of time. Kids will go through this, feel it, sense it. And then they move on to other developmental stages because that's what they do. But later, the unresolved themes from earlier pop up again, age 9, 10, 11, maybe 12. So a lot of kids at this age develop adaptations or coping or new mental health issues or challenges, rebellions, problems in school, problems at home, all kinds of issues. If you're going to have difficulties with your kids, it's most likely to get started around here. Because kids are doing two things. They're trying to recapitulate and resolve the earlier unresolved issues from the family and from their lives. And they're trying to look forward into the future when they will become a person, an adult person, moving through that world. So this is a very tricky moment. And I would say if you're going to focus your efforts on every stage that I get to here, I'm going to say, if you're going to focus your efforts on one stage, it should be this one. In focusing your efforts on this stage, there's a couple of things that are very useful to remember. One is that this is a uniquely vulnerable age. And so there are three main risks. One is risks for mental health problems, depression and anxiety being the most common, sometimes anger too. The second thing is addiction. Whether that's substance addiction or technology addiction, addiction is addiction. And the best way to define addiction is to define it as the behavior that you do that will provide self-regulation for you when you can't do it for yourself. The best example among adults is with alcoholism. Here's how you know if you're an alcoholic. If you come home at the end of your average work day, which is stressful, and you feel the need to take a drink at the end of your work day just to relax and settle down, then absolutely you are an alcoholic. Because the substance is required for you to come into a moment of self-regulation, a moment of relaxation and ease and comfort. All addictions work this way, and alcohol is particularly tricky because it kind of sneaks up on people over the course of several years, and you start off with one drink at dinner and then two drinks, or one larger drink and then two, and then you're into half a bottle, and then you become a wine connoisseur, and then you have to drink because it's education, right? And you have to spend money on it too, because after all, you're becoming a wine, and it just goes crazy, right? And here's the deal, right? You have addiction in your life somewhere. A partner, a parent, a child, a sibling, a cousin, an uncle, whatever. In your life somewhere, there's addiction. It is everywhere. And we don't talk about it at all. We're always uncomfortable talking about it. But we should recognize that addiction is pervasive. It's the most common human frailty. And it starts at this age, typically. So that means also that technology addiction starts at this age. So these are the kids who are going to get involved in high-intensity gaming and online bullying and Facebook binging and all kinds of weird stuff, weird and new stuff that is about technology behavior. So we should be super attentive with our kids when they're this age about helping them work on and deal with the emotional themes they're facing, whether those are about things that have happened in the past, in their development or in the family, or whether that's things about the future and their anxieties as they move into high school and their anxieties as they think about their future and their life and so on. This is kind of a hinge point here. It's a moment of tremendous vulnerability for young people. And in a way, you know, because it recapitulates, because development recapitulates here, there's an interesting thing. Kids will often, at this age, be like infants again. They will want to be really cuddly with parents. They don't want to leave the house. They want to just kind of lie around all the time. They're like going through another infancy. And the amount of time that's required for parents for dealing with infants, which is hours a day, is also required of parents for dealing with kids between 9 and 12. They need hours a day, hours of emotional time per day. And so I'll come back to this a little bit later, but by emotional time, what I mean is time where they talk about how they feel, what's going on in their lives, what issues are they facing, and how are they working on them. And the best way to have talks with kids in cars who are this age, the best way to have talks with kids is in cars when they're this age. The worst way to do it is to sit them down in the living room with a cup of tea, face to face, two parents facing the child across the table. Don't do that. Well, don't usually do that. The best way to talk to kids at this age is in the car. So this raises a technology issue. In your car, you probably have some technology devices. You probably have that drop-down video thing. Tonight, when you go home, take a hacksaw and just hack that thing out of there. Do not get... Okay, this is one of those things, because I bet most people are doing this. So this is one of those moments where don't feel terrible, but here's the deal. Don't give your kids devices they can use in the car. No phones, no DVD players, nothing. The car is for talking. If you go on a road trip to California, and you're going to be on the road for 20 hours, no devices. You talk. The only, one of the only ways that kids develop self-regulation is by having to figure out the moment of their experience and what they're going to do in that moment. That means dealing with boredom. Dealing with siblings who don't want to do the same things they want to do. They don't want to play the same games on the road trip. Dealing with the fact that there's hours of time in front of them and they have to do something with it. If you manage to make it work, then as you're driving to California, there's three stages. The first stage involves fighting. Like hours and hours of fighting. And then eventually giving up the fighting and then talking about whatever and making up songs, making up games, trying new things. And then, this is the reward you get. After some period of time, kids will go quiet and they'll look out the window and they'll say amazing things like, man, look at the stars out there. The universe is just incredible. That's the payoff. That's the full cycle of self-regulation development. And that moment of openness to awesome, wonderful, amazing, sacred things in the universe is the jump start that kids need for this next stage of development, which we'll get to in a minute. So the only way you can get there is by providing moments of stillness and reflection and self-regulation for young people. They have to learn these skills. And nowadays, when most kids have a phone, there is never a moment of self-reflection available. Every second when there's a point, yeah, pull out the phone. Okay, now, talk about kids, but you guys do this too, right? Like, adults do this. Adults are just as addicted as kids are. They're just pulling out their devices all the time. Anytime there's any moment of anxiety. Like, I see this socially a lot with adults. Adults will enter a room, like maybe tonight you did it. You'll enter a room, you know, some people, but not everybody, and you're like, I don't know what to do. Should I talk to somebody? Should I introduce myself to somebody? And in that little moment of anxiety, while you're figuring that out, you go, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll just make myself feel better. I'll pull up my device and I'll check whatever stupid thing is new on the internet. And you feel totally better. And you're in your little bubble there. Nobody will talk to you. You can be all isolated and okay. The device is self-regulating you. That's addiction. And that's a problem. Okay. And then we got 13 to 15. I talked about the 15-year-old already, right? Also an age of great vulnerability. But with a twist, kids at this age start to search for mentors. And there's an interesting developmental thing where somewhere between 15 and 25, mentorship becomes the most important thing in a child's life. Can be more important than parenting. And so we need to help kids find mentors. And what's happening with technology is that technology is becoming a false mentor for so many kids. Kids are getting mentored by video games. Kids are getting mentored by binge-watching Netflix. Kids are being mentored or not finding mentors in healthy ways in the community. Most of the mentors that we used to have in our communities have been dismantled. Most of those relationships have been dismantled. And finding mentors is becoming more and more difficult to do. If you get to this age, 13, 14, 15, and your child has a laptop in their bedroom and is doing high-intensity video gaming at night, and when you knock on the door and ask them what they're doing, they do something furtive and put the thing away, then you have a problem. And parents have various reactions to this. Typically, parents want to take the computer away. They want to revoke computer privileges. Who's done that, by the way? Yeah, like 25 people. So it's the most common parental response. What else are you supposed to do in that moment? At that moment, kids have a choice. They can choose to lock the door. They can choose to take the laptop and go to somebody else's house. And at that point, it becomes quite difficult. And you're talking about a months-long negotiation with your child about how to fix this. And parents come up with all kinds of interesting solutions to this problem. One solution is obvious, which is that no child should have a web-enabled device in their bedroom at nighttime. That's a basic rule, and you've probably heard that a million times before. But it bears repeating. No child should have a web-enabled device in their bedroom at any time. All computers should be in open, public, family spaces. And all these devices should be gathered up before everybody goes to bed and put away somewhere. So there's no temptation. Here's the deal. A child of 15 does not have sufficient self-regulation to hear or feel the ping from their phone at night with the lights off, and not look at it to see what it is, and not click whatever it is their buddy has sent them, and not to look at whatever crazy thing their buddy has sent them, and not to go, ooh, wow, and not to get all furtive about it because they know that if the parents find out, they're going to take their device away. So it's unfair, really unfair, for us as adults to expect kids to do something that developmentally they are not capable of doing. We are not capable of doing it. Like, you know, adults sleep with their phones by their beds and they go, what's that? So we should not impose this unfairness on children by expecting them to do something that developmentally they can't do and that we ourselves can't do. So you want to unwind this as much as you can into the early development of kids so that by the time they get through this period from birth up to age 9, the family has a set of practices. Things like people don't have devices in their bedrooms. Not everybody has a cell phone. You don't need a cell phone. Really, you don't need a cell phone as a young person until you learn how to drive a car. Yeah, you don't. If you as a 12-year-old, I don't know, you have to go home by yourself after school and you walk through a dark forest in which there are wolves, then you probably could do with a phone. But other than that, no. The only time you need a phone is when you get involved in life or death risk, and that is when you begin to drive a car. That's a life or death risk kind of deal. If you don't do it right, you can kill yourself or kill somebody else. So at that moment, for safety, kids need a phone. But before that, they don't. In my experience working with young people is that the kids who haven't had the phone all the way along, they like the fact they don't have a phone. It gets them out of the bullying thing online. It gets them out of having to be addicted to the phone, which is almost inevitable if you have a kid who's got a phone with them all day long. It's so addictive, you really can't avoid it. It's really tough for them. So if you can avoid it, you could develop a set of family values and practices that say, this is what we do. We don't have devices in the car. We talk in the car. We don't have devices at meals. We talk during meals. We don't have devices at night in bedrooms. We use devices sometimes. We spend time watching television together as a family, which I think is a great idea, by the way. The best way to use technology as a family is to kind of gather up and collect all your screen time for the week and put it into one evening, Friday or Saturday night, and watch a couple of movies together as a family. That works. But if you kind of spread it out and you give kids a certain number of minutes every day, you know this doesn't work, right? It doesn't work. Because the kid will say, okay, so if I don't use all of my minutes today, can I add them to minutes tomorrow? And then I have to do a certain number of minutes for homework because it's on the computer. So that doesn't count toward my minutes. And they have endless negotiation skills around just increasing this amount. It's crazy. You're better off, I'll talk more about this in a bit, but you're better off just saying, look, we don't watch TV, or do recreational stuff or play video games during the week. We do a bit of that on the weekend, fair enough. But on the week, we do some other stuff. Okay. And then adolescents. So here we're over here. This is ideally this moment of discovery of getting out into the world. Transformative travel, transformative intimacy, self-regulation, finding path and purpose, finding mentors, and developing deep skill in something. Playing the piano. When your child is 5, you can say, you will learn to play the piano. When your child is 12, you cannot say, you will continue to play the piano if you wish them to love playing the piano. You can say, do you still wish to play the piano? If not, what do you wish to do? You can do that. When kids are 18, you cannot say, you will play the piano. They have to negotiate this. The family has to negotiate it, right? So much of this stuff builds on itself. So we're looking toward creating a human who has good self-regulation, who has a sense of purpose and passion and depth, and who is able to move out into that world in a healthy way. Notice none of this stuff is itself about technology. It's about how you build a human, how you build a healthy human. And that's kind of the way, that's kind of this intersection of these various themes between culture and technology and economics and so on. They all weave together underneath this kind of philosophy of what does it mean to be a purposeful, self-regulated, autonomous person? But there's a real mismatch, as we know, right? Part of it's about technology. The rates of depression and anxiety are skyrocketing. In a room like this, there'd be, if we are a representative population here, there'd be 50, 40 people with crippling depression. And there'd be about 30 people who experience paralyzing anxiety pretty regularly. That's normal. So the rates of mental health challenges are very high right now, mostly because our self-regulation has been messed with by our technology. The rates of isolation, social isolation, are actually on the rise as well. They're higher than they've ever been in the history of humanity. That is mostly because when people stand at a bus stop now, they don't talk to each other. They talk to their phones. The rates of suicide among middle-aged people in North America are higher than they've ever been recorded right now. So, man, we're sick. We got a lot of issues going on. And a big chunk of them can be traced right back to this technology issue where we've surrendered our self-regulation. We don't spend as much time together. We don't spend as much time in nature. We are allowing the technology to entrain us in its own self-regulation, or this kind of false self-regulation. It's a problem. And now we're seeing this new wave of young people who are getting through high school and stopping. They don't know where to go. They don't know what to do. They've grown up with technology, the first generation in the history of humanity who was born into the age of technology, digital technology, and they're stuck. They're depressed. They're anxious. Some of them go off to university and drop out after a year. And then come back home, live in their parents' basement, binge watch Netflix, get high with their buddies. A lot of people, a lot of young people right now. Okay, so how would we close that gap? How would we help to make some kind of intervention in this challenging social, cultural, economic, spiritual environment that we have? Some of these things I've already mentioned. If you can get away with it, no screens, none. Before age 3. No television. No Barney. I don't even know what the kids shows these. Barney is what I know. My kids are in their 20s, right? No screens. Risk education for little kids, right? This is a risk, like I said, and you could talk to your kids about this. Incremental amounts. Somewhere between 5 and 9, kids are going to start to use the computer. They're going to use a computer at school. They're going to go to the library in kindergarten, and they're going to do something with a 25-year-old computer in the library. But yeah, I mean, they have to learn how to use this stuff. So we should help them learn that. Somewhere between 5 and 9. And the actual number of minutes per day is important, but impossible to define. And that's why I didn't put it up there for 5 to 9-year-olds. We're talking about a few minutes of time on the computer a day, or a few minutes of watching television, or one movie night per week. Totally reasonable. But less than 30 minutes a day, ideally. That is an ideal. Nobody has that these days. If you could get away with that, if you can make that work, and you can if you have little kids. If your kids are 1 and 3, you can do all of this. You just do it. Because you have all the authority and autonomy, and they don't have any. And then the kids grow up in this environment of values around healthy technology use. And it totally works. If you try to intervene later and make some changes, it gets harder and harder the older the kids are. Of course, until at age 15, it's an extended negotiation over many months with lots of false starts. So ideally, try to find small ways to ratchet it back if you feel like there's too much time being spent on devices. Don't just intervene as a parent and say, we've decided, your parents have decided that we're going to do this. Talk to your kids about risk. Talk to your kids about what they see among their peers. Talk to their kids about their own anxiety. Kids are super educated about this kind of stuff. They are well aware that they spend too much time on screens. They just can't do anything about it because they don't yet have the self-regulation to throttle it back. So our job as parents is to set boundaries for them, to say, okay, here's the boundary that we're going to set as a family. And it starts out with parents making all the rules, and then kids having some say in the rules, and then parents and kids having lots of conversations and negotiations and revisiting and revising the rules continually to age 18, kids having to do it on their own, which is scary, of course. But if we did some of these things and wove them into our daily lives in small incremental movements, it would help. Things like talking in the car instead of watching in the car. Talking at meals instead of texting at meals. Everybody I ever ask about this says, oh yeah, at meals we talk. No devices at meals in our family. And yet every white spot I go into where there's a bunch of families at the tables, everybody's on a device. So people lie. Okay. So screens for kids 12 to 18. Collaboration and negotiation, like I said. Self-regulation training. Dealing with risk. Between 12 and 18, kids need to be exposed to a level of risk that is potentially fatal. They need this. Early childhood development risk is about you could slightly hurt yourself if you fall at the playground. 5 to 9 risk is you can hurt yourself a lot if you don't think it through. My brother and I, it's just occurred to me, he and I used to play rock fights when we were this age. So we go in the back lane, and you pick up a rock, you know, you feel like you could huck about, you know, 20 meters, and you just 1, 2, 3, and you huck your rock. I put my brother in the hospital twice. I hit him right in the head multiple times. It was awesome. Yeah, good self-regulation. Kids need to manage risk, you know? And when they get to 12, 13, 14, I think it's awesome that high schools often provide some kind of outdoor experience trip for kids this age. That's perfect. You know, you go on a canoe trip, you go on a kayak trip, you go on a hiking trip. If you don't do this right, you could die. Or other people could die. So you got to do it right. You got to learn to manage that risk properly. And if they learn how to manage these risks, then two things happen. One is they get engaged in something that's very deep and purposeful. So kids will often discover a sport or a skill at this age that involves risk that they love. And that will take them in itself away from some of the technology time. The kids who get involved in high-intensity video gaming do so here at this age. And they say stuff. They say crazy stuff. Like, high-intensity gaming is more intense than anything else in my life. Really? We haven't done any really intense then. Let's go whitewater kayaking. Let's go play paintball. Let's go rock climbing. And let's see how intense you feel. Most of the time, if you give kids an opportunity, they will choose an activity that is not on the computer or not on a device. They will choose to go outside. They will choose to play a game. They will choose to go to a destination. They will do it, but so many of them are just stuck at home. And that's a problem of our culture at the moment because so many families have a situation where both parents work. And so the kids are at home a lot. And that's a very difficult thing to fix. It is fixable through the finding of mentors for our kids. So parents aren't facilitating these activities, but mentors are. And finding the mentor is something I'll get to in a bit. And then for these kids, out into the world, right? They need to have self-regulation by age 18, which means they need to know how to manage technology by themselves. This is an ever-changing landscape. The issue right now for kids 18 to 28 is two things. One, binge-watching Netflix, which, as you know, is crazy addictive. Like, it's just so easy to push the button. Or not, you don't even have to push the button. Depending on your device, it will say, playing next episode in 10 seconds. And you go, okay. Like, you don't even have to move. It just keeps going. YouTube is the same. This is really bad for us. Terrible for us. So a lot of young people are involved in just getting swallowed up in this world the way that alcoholics are swallowed up by alcoholism. It kind of creeps up on you, and pretty soon you're spending, you know, in the world of binge-watching, you're spending 12 hours a day binge-watching Netflix. That is bad. And everybody who does this, all the young people who do this, they know this is bad. And most of the time, they're really struggling with it. How do I stop doing this? It's totally addictive. Mentors can really help with that. Mentors will help them get involved in activities that are purposeful, that are out in the world, that take them away from that, that provide alternative methods of self-regulation. All that works. All that is about alternative to screens. Okay. So, when we think about dealing with this kind of avalanche of difficulty, the place to start is not with how do we reduce technology use. That's our instinct. That's the place we think, oh, this is the solution. If only my child was on the screen less, that would be better for everyone. That is the wrong question. The right question is why? Why so much use? What's it doing? The answer is always emotional management. Always. All addictions work this way. Emotional management means that the technology or the activity with the technology is providing some kind of emotional management for the child when they are not able to provide it for themselves. It helps them feel relaxed, or it helps them feel strong or confident or whatever, empowered. It provides a substitute mentorship, essentially. So when we think about what's happening with our kids, instead of asking in a superficial way about the technology and managing habits of technology, we should go a little deeper and ask ourselves about personal growth, personal healing. And these are really difficult to confront in your family. because you have stuff in your family that's unresolved. You do. Everybody does. Maybe there's stuff, if the child, here, let's go to birth here. There's probably stuff back there in previous generations of the family that's unresolved. Stuff you've probably never talked about, which exerts its influence on the current generation. Just speaking for me personally, let me think of a couple of things. So I had, I had two cousins commit suicide. I had four alcoholic grandparents. I'm adopted. That's enough to have a conversation. And that's just the short list. So I have a choice as a parent. I can try to shield myself, shield my kids from all this if I want to. And my impulse to do so, my urge to do so, would have exactly the opposite effect than the effect I intend. Because my kids would grow up and they would know, they would sense that there's something back there, because we never talk about something. We talk about lots and lots of different things, and then, oh no, we just change the subject when it goes over there. We don't talk about that, and they know something is off. And that traumatizes them in ways that are difficult to define. They sense it and they feel it. And so one of the things we could do much better is we could recognize the legacies we bring with us as parents and how we unavoidably will invite our kids to join that culture with all of its wounds. We can't help but do that. That's how life works. And so we need to be prepared to talk to our kids about some of the difficult things that have happened in our own backgrounds. And that can be extraordinarily difficult for parents to do. But if we don't do it, then the kids have no possibility to heal from the things that have hurt us and have hurt our families. So if we want our kids to live better lives than we have, to have different legacies than we have brought, we need to talk to them about the most difficult, secretive things in our families. And of course, there's a right age to do that and a right way to do that, and it's easy to mess it up. It has big consequences if you mess it up, potentially. But we need to find ways to do that, to bring the world of our kids into their world. And then as we go along, you know, as the kids grow up and as we get older, things happen to them and to us. Traumas happen, situations, difficulties, challenges. We need to be willing to talk to them about that as well. Doing all of this is about creating an environment of emotional safety for our kids. That environment of emotional safety is the best environment to encourage self-regulation. And self-regulation is the key to managing technology wisely. So you can see how the conversation doesn't start with technology, it ends with technology. It starts with creating a healthy family where people feel emotionally safe to deal with stuff, to discuss stuff, and to figure out especially how to extract the wisdom that's hidden inside of our wounding, which we all carry, right? So this next bit, when I talk about alternative to screens, it's not so much about practically thinking about just dragging your kid away from the screen. It's philosophically about digging beneath why your child is on the screen so much and what is the emotional benefit they're deriving from that, and how could you help them get that same emotional benefit in some other way. So that's what the activities are about. And they start with emotional safety. So for little kids, finding space where they can share their feelings. Don't hit your kids. The evidence for this is overwhelming. Absolutely, it's the most researched thing, exhaustively researched thing in all of childhood psychology. Kids who are hit are traumatized by the experience of being hit. That's how it goes. You can't avoid it. You can't hit your kids safely. So as we move along in thinking about early childhood development, there are simple things like this that we should be attentive to. Creating an environment where they can feel emotionally safe so that later, when they're dealing with the difficulties of technology and the challenges as an 8, 9, 10, 11, or 12-year-old, they feel emotionally safe to talk to us about it. So that when they're 14 or 15 or 16 and we're driving in the car and something terrible happened at school, they feel safe enough to talk to us about it. If you haven't done any of this conversation and discussion all the way along, and at 15, you're driving in the car, and your DVD player is broken, and you say to your kids, so how you doing? They're not going to say anything. You have to start as soon as you can, right? You can do it later with lots of work, but it's better to start earlier, as with so many things. So stuff like cultivating self-awareness and strengthening relationship skills and finding mentors and all that is stuff I've already said, but it bears the point that the technology piece is not about technology. The technology piece is about humanity and about childhood development. For adolescents, get them outside. Please go outside. Go somewhere. We live in the most beautiful part of the world. Go somewhere outside safely, but somewhere really risky also. Young people are increasingly spending all of their time inside. They don't want to go outside. They're afraid of nature. I took a group of university students outside to a small park recently. And a bunch of them were like, oh, this is awesome. Let's go outside. This is every time. So every class outside. And a couple of them were like, oh, outside. Oh. They had little mini panic attacks by going to the park. This is becoming normal. So it's a problem. We should help kids learn self-regulation through nature, because it turns out that there are two things that profoundly impact your self-regulation skill. One is active self-regulation practice, and that is by having moments of mindfulness where you sit, you just breathe, and you notice yourself and your environment for 5 minutes. That totally works with self-regulation. In the old days, that was called sitting in the doctor's office waiting for an appointment, right? Now it's called self-regulation training and mindfulness practice. So that's one thing. The other thing is nature. Going for a walk. Going for a walk in nature has a profound effect on self-regulation and a strange and transformative effect on mental health for people. So get people outside, especially young people. Help them cultivate a deep skill. Okay, between 12 and 18, what you're looking for in a young person is their discovery of the deep love of a certain subject. Doesn't matter what it is. It's often something weird from your point of view. But they love it. And they want to go travel to that place where people do that thing. They want to read all the books about that thing. They want to go to the weird conference in some other country where they talk about this thing once a year. And your job as a parent is to help them do it, provided it's safe and legal. And managing the big risks, like driving a car. Texting has now exceeded drunk driving as the main cause of serious car accidents in British Columbia. So I think it's fair to say that driving has become a bigger big risk recently because of technology. I work with a lot of young people around this age, and They all are very judgmental about texting while driving, and they all do it. Yeah. And finding mentors I talked about. Because mentorship is the key deal. If you have a rocky childhood, all kinds of things go badly. That is fixable via healthy mentorship between ages 15 and 25. That's how the original resilience research was done, with kids who had been deeply traumatized in their early childhood, but who later showed full recovery. How did this happen? It happened through the exposure to a healthy mentor at some point. So mentorship is this magic bullet thing. The word mentor, by the way, is actually not a word, it's a name. It comes from Homer's Odyssey, this story about Odysseus who goes off to the Trojan War and is gone for 20 years, leaving his wife and his son on the island of Ithaca. when he goes on this journey, the goddess Athena, who is the goddess of prophecy and wisdom, she looks down from Mount Olympus and she sees that Odysseus' son, whose name is Telemachus, will grow up without a father because Odysseus is going to be gone for 20 years. And she sees that because she knows the future. But she also foresees that when Odysseus comes back from the war, there will be a little war on the island of Ithaca and Telemachus will be killed unless she does something about it. So the goddess Athena disguises herself as an old man and goes to live in the village with Telemachus and guides him. And the name that she takes when she goes to live in the village as an old man is Mentor. That's where the name comes from. That's where the word comes from. And it is this ancient source of all these mentorship characters like Merlin and Gandalf and Yoda and so on. Mentorship is a magical deal. It has a very rich resonance in our culture, in every culture, because it makes a difference. Mentorship is a deep and sacred trust between a young person and a dependable, healthy adult. So if we were thinking about where we put our efforts as a culture these days, we should put them into mentorship. Mentorship is the way of diversion from technology addiction. It's the way of cultivation of healthy self-regulation for young people. Mentorship is a beautiful thing. Helps us build self-awareness and empathy and character. The thing, the gold standard for what a human is, right? What a human can be. That slippery, hard to define term, character, that we can identify easily, but we can't easily define. So help your kids find mentors. And mentors cannot be parents. You, helicopter parents. Help your kids find mentors, not you. And the mentor, if you draw a Venn diagram between the parent and the mentor, it should not be like completely overlapping. It should be like half overlapping. The mentor should be different from you. They should be a different age, maybe a different gender, maybe a different culture, maybe a slightly different but overlapping values. Yeah. And that person provides a kind of special skill for young people. Some of those skills are listed up there, right? And I've already spoken about most of them. The mentor helps the child to understand these developmental legacies. When I was 13, I ran away from home, and I went to my grandmother's house. My grandmother was this old lady who made tea and sat me down in the front room of her house. And I was super upset about all the crazy stuff going on at home with my addicted, violent, abusive mom. And she said to me, "You know, I don't know what's happened, really. I know it's terrible for you, but I want you to know that however all this goes, you will get through it. You will get through it." And I did. And I ended up living with her for 5 or 6 years after running away from home. And she saved my life, really, literally saved my life. And many young people who are in difficulty and great challenge have this kind of an experience with a mentor. It doesn't have to be someone you live with or a long-term relationship kind of deal, but mentorship is a way of providing emotional safety when it can't be found anywhere else and in any other kind of relationship. Being a good mentor requires an amazing deep level of skill in interpersonal connection, and these days they're getting harder to find. But if we can help our kids find healthy mentors, even if they're not, you know, counseling types, but they're just different and they're supportive, that's wonderful. My kids found interesting mentors out in the world that are people who are very different from me, people who would sometimes make fun of me, which is okay and important. You've probably seen the research about mindset and the importance of mindset for kids and mindset around dealing with technology, the importance of recognizing that it's not an avalanche. You can deal with it. You can reduce your technology use, find better things to do. You can build healthy relationships. Just being able to articulate the intention of that, the goal of doing that as a family. This is something that's very important to do, because if you try to make an intervention, especially around technology with your kids, especially after going home tonight, you're going to try something. It's not going to work. And you're like, damn it, that guy. So you have to try something else. So my encouragement is to try a bunch of different things and keep a positive mindset. That, you know, something will work. Something will work, especially if you negotiate with your kids about it. Use them as a resource. You have to try a whole bunch of different things, and you have to be consistent. Like sitting with your kids when they do homework. If they're under 18, sit with them. Sit with them at night when they do their homework. They cannot just go and do their homework on the computer. Are you kidding me? They get 4 seconds into that task, and then they're flipping tabs and on Facebook and texting, and it's crazy. You're doing the same thing. But if you sit together, then you can keep each other honest a little bit. And you can have a nice family time around tasks that people need to do on the computer. That's super important. And it cultivates this mindset of, we're just going to keep trying things till we figure this out in a way that works for everyone. There's no magic bullet, no secret sauce here. We just have to keep working on it because we recognize this is important. This is crucial for the development of our family, for our kids, and for their future. Self-regulation, by the way, is correlated with life success more than any other single factor. It's correlated with life success more than intelligence and more than socioeconomic status, which is surprising. The skill of self-regulation, the skill of being able to manage your emotional life internally and therefore deal with other people in the world effectively, is the gold standard skill for people. And the biggest problem with technology is that it gets in the way of self-regulation. And if we just keep that in mind, and if we keep asking ourselves, how could we tweak this a little bit so that we turn this from hours and hours and hours of doing this on the computer to a little bit less of this on the computer, a little bit more of something else in the world that teaches our kids skill at something. And the last two, I think, are very important. We don't talk about love too much in our society. I don't know why. It's become a dirty word somehow. But two things are important about love. One is, it doesn't matter how much you love your kids, really. Everybody loves their kids. What matters is how much your kids love you back. That's the key. It's how much they love you. Because the extent to which they love you will determine how willing they are to work with you on this and to collaborate and negotiate about this. So it's all about how much they love you. And your ability to make them love you is all about your ability to create a safe emotional environment for them where they can be themselves, they can express themselves, and they can share and talk and discuss things with you without you becoming judgmental or super parental or weird. And your ability to set boundaries and to set safe space for them so that they can manage things like technology. A child of 7 may say, yes, here's the little egg timer beside the computer. I set it to 20 minutes and I will get off after 20 minutes. They won't, probably. But you can help them by showing up half a minute before the timer goes off and just saying, how's it going? I notice your timer's coming up there. You know, okay, you ready? Hey, yeah, do that. So it's not about being punitive or disciplinarian, but about recognizing this is a complex, nuanced kind of situation where kids need lots of help from us, lots of emotional help and support. And the more we can do that, the more we encourage them to, it's not an equation exactly, but yeah, sure, we encourage them to love us more, which is helpful. And a couple of final things, practical steps for technology. What I thought we would do is finish up with these last two, take a 5-minute break, and then come back for questions, because there are an infinite number of permutations in this scenario. So let's do that. I have two more. It's 7:45-ish. and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back. Okay, practical steps for technology. One, ask why. Like I said before, ask your kids and ask yourself, why is the technology so appealing? What is it? What is the emotional hit you get from this experience? And ask yourself as a parent, how could I help my child achieve that same level of emotional fulfillment in some other activity that is not on a screen? That's a very important question. So I'll say it again. Ask yourself why your child, and ask your child why, they are involved in this technology and what is the emotional benefit they get from it. A child of any age can answer this question. And then once you know what the emotional benefit of it is, ask yourself, how can we as a family come up with things we could do so that some of that emotional benefit is achieved through some other means? That's a great place to start. Negotiate screen time as a family, as I said. Cultivate skillful alternatives to screens. Skills. Deep skills. The skills that take us toward unanswerable questions. Any deep skill will do this. If you learn how to rebuild a car engine, it doesn't take you very long before you start to get into the world of all disciplines of knowledge, all sciences, all arts. It's all connected. And it doesn't take you very long if you follow that path to these unanswerable questions, deep questions about the universe. Those are really important questions for kids to grapple with, especially during adolescence. Mentors and parents can help them do that. Risk, I talked about. And mentorship, I talked about. The main thing is to stay in the conversation and not look for simple solutions. Well, you might stumble upon some simple solutions. But stay in the conversation with your kids. Every day should have some kind of conversation about technology. How did we do today with our tech? Every day. Also, every day should have a conversation about emotions. Kids from 0 to 2 just take all of your time no matter what. So kids 2, starting at 2 when they get angry and they want to bite you. Lots of conversation about feelings there. Kids from 2 through 7, 8, 9 need an hour a day of emotional conversation, roughly. Now, the average parent in Canada doesn't exactly achieve that amount. The average mom in Canada spends 3 minutes a day with her kids talking about feelings and emotions. The average dad in Canada, it's a little less as you might expect, it's 90 seconds. 90 seconds of non-task related stuff. Lots of talk about, did you clean up your room? Did you unload the dishwasher? Have you done your chores for today? But very little talk about, how are you feeling? How'd it go? Like, what was it like today, you know? What was happening with your peers? How do you feel? Are you tired? Do you feel good? How do we work with that? If kids start to get emotional conversation every day, they get used to it. If you try to start at age 15, it's going to be a chore. But an hour a day up to about age 12, 13, 14, yeah. And then age 15, 16, 17, it starts to get down to about half an hour a day. So it does go up and down, but every day should have a lot of this discussion about how we're doing. For you too. You need half an hour a day as an adult. Talk about your feelings. How did your day go today? You heard a bunch of stuff in this presentation tonight. And you're going to hear some bunch of stuff in the questions. How do you feel about all that? And who are you going to talk to about it? What are you going to do when you talk about it? And what about all this stuff I said about secrets, family secrets, back here in previous generations? Do you talk about that? I don't know. Should you? Probably. So we live in this world where we're so entrained on the devices that we're losing the art of conversation. The art of conversation is essential for all of this. It kind of facilitates the whole process. So stay in the conversation. Build that conversation in your family as much as you can. And don't look for the easy thing. Look for the thing that's going to work, the thing that you try iteratively many times. Don't be frustrated if for the first month or so of trying new things, you don't really get much traction, especially if kids are deeply addicted, especially if they're 13, 14, 15. They're deeply addicted to their technology, to their devices. You're not going to fix this in a week or a month. You could fix it in a year, but that's how long it's going to take, really. If your kids are 3, 4, 5, you can fix it in a day. You just change the rules. But not over here. And many of you are going to have kids at this age, right? It takes time. Like anything meaningful takes time. Now, speaking of time, it's just after 7:50. I'm going to take a 6-7 minute break. We're going to start up right at 8 o'clock, and we're going to have questions. My first question is this. How are we doing so far? Okay, break time. Thank you. Okay, people. We're going to start in 1 minute. Okay, folks, we're going to start up in 1 minute. All right, thank you. I'm glad you're finding it useful.
We have 50-year-olds.
Good.
We're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
There's a few things we can really do better. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like I was saying, it's this ongoing negotiation. Okay, folks, so we'll just get started, and I know there's some people who are still eating their awesome cake out there, and they'll kind of filter in as they finish. I wanted to start with a question that I got at the break about different maturity levels for kids, and, you know, if they're the same age, should you have the same rules, and if not, should they be different, and should you treat your kids differently based on their gender or their maturity level, and if so, how might that work? One way that I can answer that question is to talk about the maturity gap. So when kids are born, developmentally for the first couple of years, they're mostly on the same path. They gather their maturity at about the same rate till about age 7. When they're in school in grade 2 or so, 2 or 3, boys hit the first phase of boy bully culture. So boys get stuck a little bit there sometimes, and they slow down a bit in their development. And girls surge ahead. So girls might be a year or two more mature than boys through grades 4, 5, and 6. And then girls hit the first phase of mean girl culture, which stops a lot of girls and is really traumatizing. And boys resolve their boy bully culture by grade 4, grade 3 or 4. They beat the crap out of each other a couple times and they're done. And then they're buddies. It's kind of weird. So they catch up to girls, and around grade 7 or so, boys and girls can be right at the same level of maturity. This is, of course, not a universal rule. And then grade 8, they go ahead, and grade 9, boys hit the first phase of jackass culture. And for many boys, this stops them. Stops their development for, like, almost a decade. And girls surge ahead. They do. They surge ahead. And they get a little bump of mean girl culture, grade 11, 12. But they get over it. And they keep going. So you can get this situation where two kids are both 20 years old. And the girl is 5 years more mature than the boy. That's a really interesting process. So I think in families we often see this kind of disparity. One or the other can be the same age or a similar age, but they can be ahead or behind. And it's very tricky to work this out, especially because kids are acutely aware of the principle of fairness. So if you're going to have different rules for people at different ages, you know, if you didn't set a certain rule for your daughter, and then your son gets to the same age and you set a rule for him, the first thing he'll say is, but you didn't set this rule for her. That's not fair. Ideally, you want to back this conversation up so that kids know from a very early age that they're different and that sometimes the rules for one are not going to be exactly the same as the rules for another because different kids need different situations and different cultivation of values in different ways so that they can mature in a way that's best for them. So it's okay to have different practices, even different rules, but the standard should be that in a moment of self-regulation and relaxation and self-reflection, both kids say, yeah, that's fair. If the kids, when they're not being defensive and angry, when they're in a moment where, when they're in a reflective moment about their lives and they have some insight about it, when they say, yeah, that's more or less fair, then you're doing okay. If they consistently complain about it not being fair again and again and again, then it raises the question about negotiation. Should you talk about this some more and come up with something so that they can work with you a little bit? Okay. Now, questions.
My daughter and my son are exactly that. She's 14 and has supremely gifted self-regulation, like from birth or some reason. She just has internal moral compass, and so the rules for her and for him are very different.
Yeah. Right, I'm the bad one. I'm the stupid one.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, man. How old is he?
He's 11.
So if we remember the slide where I talked about 11-year-olds, it's this really vulnerable moment, right, where the earlier developmental issues can kind of resurface again if there were some, and there's a lot of anxiety about the future and who I'm going to be and whether I'm okay, and a lot of issues, worries about confidence, that kind of thing. And so for an 11-year-old to have an older sibling who's a high performer, this is normally very problematic. Because it's hard, they can't measure up by the standards that have been set by the culture, but you can change the standards of the family. So, two suggestions. One is be careful about overly endorsing your daughter's method as the right path. As the path that he should follow. So in other words, he would, if he becomes more like her, then he wouldn't need these same rules. Try to avoid that because he will never get there. He will always be, a little different. He's probably more creative. He's probably more spontaneous. He's probably more playful. He's probably got a better sense of humor. Those kinds of things, right? So the trick at age 11 is to bolster the self-esteem of that child by helping them find something that they can be really good at that the other sibling can't match. So there's something he could do that she'd never be able to do. She'd be terrible at. Except computer gaming. So find something. Okay, so ask the question about what is the emotional benefit he gleans from this. And if the emotional benefit is mastery, a sense of uniqueness and fun and play, then maybe computer gaming turns into robotics, or maybe it turns into making, or maybe it turns into building stuff, or maybe it turns into, you know, making science projects, whatever. But try to tweak the energy so it doesn't get kind of railroaded down in this one pathway. Obviously, it's something of great interest in. Let's see how we could broaden it out a bit. Find something that he can really lock into that will lead deeply to some purposeful activity that he can surpass her in. And that sounds crass, but that's really the solution. He has to find a way to carve out his own niche. And this, by the way, this is the most common sibling issue. The oldest child is normally more self-disciplined, more of a rule follower, better academically, typically, because academics are set up this way, more judgmental. more structured, more orderly, all that kind of stuff. And the second child to come along grows up in a different family. Because the first child grows up in this family where the parents are at this the first time. They're super anxious. They're super rule-followy themselves. They want to make sure they get everything right. They tweak every little thing. And so the child gets this really customized, lovely environment of, you know, just, here you go. And then the second person comes along, and the parents are exhausted. They realize they don't need so many rules. Like, you don't have, like, when you have your first child, you have a million of these little things you try to do. The second child, you kind of relax a lot of that a bit. If you have more kids, eventually, if you have five kids, the last kid raises themselves. But, you know, by the second kid, the second child does not grow up in the same family, because the second child's growing up in a family where there's two parents who are more relaxed about this kind of stuff, and one other sibling who's, like, a little Nazi about stuff. And so they get it from all sides, and so they're doing a different thing. And our society supports much more, supports this kind of orderly type person. Our notions of achievement are largely based on your ability to build orderly things and chain them together into something we call success, which is fine. But that leaves these other kids in this situation. Well, how am I supposed to compete with that? How can I find my unique place in this family? I can't compete with my older sibling. I feel like an idiot. I feel like, you know, why did you have me? I have no place. And that always surfaces at age 11, 12. So it's totally normal what he's experiencing, actually. Not to minimize it, but this is totally normal. So you got to find something that he can do that's unique and different, that she does has no interest in and couldn't do even if she tried. That's usually not that hard. It requires trying a few activities out over the course of a year or two and seeing which ones stick, and then really cultivating and pushing those. Yeah? Okay. What else? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think modeling is one aspect of parenting and mentoring that is absolutely crucial. You can't very well expect your kids to have proper self-regulation with tech if you yourself run your device all the time. Yeah. Yeah. How old is he?
14.
Yeah, by then, if you make some kind of comment, he'll kind of quickly go to the Wikipedia page that shows that reading on a tablet is just as good as reading. Yeah. I think at that age, it's about having this ongoing conversation. And you can make deals. You can say, I make you a deal. The next book that we read, the next two books we read, we'll swap. You read it on the page, and I'll read it on the device. We'll see what happens. Just as an experiment. Not trying to rock your world. I'm just seeing what we can do, right? If you can keep it playful and keep it open, then you can see what happens. That's the old thing. Yeah. By the time kids are 14, 15, they have two things going for them or against them, which are this tendency to be quite opinionated and knowledgeable about these things. And the resistance to authority, yeah. And so you can get in this little tricky thing. And I would say in general, expect this age to be the toughest age with technology. They recognize now that they can break the rules, that you can't really do much, right? You might think you can, but they know you can't. And so 14, 15 is this age where it often becomes the most difficult of all, because they're using technology all the time for school, and they've usually got their own devices by now, and often they want to have stuff in their bedroom. That should be an ironclad rule, no stuff in bedrooms. But beyond that, they're always going to be inching up on you. And that one is just difficult. That age is just difficult for this kind of thing. And it's a matter of keeping the conversation going every single day. Okay, and question?
You talked earlier about the stuff that happens in secret.
Yeah.
At what age should you be having these conversations, and what types of conversations should you
Sure.
My son is 7, and I'm a single dad, so a few years ago when things happened, and he does go through issues, and then he's always trying to grab my phone, and I'm feeling that that's up, and when I try to take it back, there's a struggle there, and I'll be like, Mommy, is this, and you go, and you go, that.
Yeah, so ideally, it often happens that parents have different rules. If kids are in two different homes, there's different rules about technology, and it's one way that parents who are parenting singly get in trouble between the parents and the kids because they're often not on the same page. That's a real problem. As far as sharing stuff that is traumatic, with little kids, what you can do is you can ask them about what they want to know. They often may not, at this age, want to know very much. They may be aware of something. You may go to a family event, and there's a person there who gets really drunk and irresponsible and acts out and wrecks the party for everybody. Happens all the time. And your child of 3 will be in that experience, and they won't know what to do about it. So you can ask them. You can say, you know, what do you want to know about that? Right? We're driving in the car on the way home. And they'll say something. They'll say, why was so-and-so acting like this way? And you say, well, and you, at this point, you need to be honest. You say, well, so-and-so has a problem with alcohol. As many people do, actually. And it's something they've been struggling with for a long time. And if you can say it in non-judgmental language like that, that's best. Don't say, you know, so-and-so's a jerk. And wrecks every family gathering. And stole my Tonka truck when I was 6. Both of my siblings have struggled with addiction. And it's been a constant theme in my family our whole lives. And in the generations previous. And we've had lots of conversations about this. And at different ages, my kids have wanted to know different things. Sometimes it's appropriate... Often it's appropriate to keep somebody else's privacy private. I don't think we need to say everything. What I think we need to do is be willing to have a conversation with our kids about extracting the learning from a given situation. Here's what we should learn from this situation. And talk about it as much as we need to, especially when the topic is uncomfortable, so that our kids are educated about the importance of talking things through. So that is... addictions, mental health issues, marijuana. This is not a talk on addictions, but I should say something about marijuana. Because it's the most abused substance we have in BC, and it's deeply problematic. All the other substances have, ways in for the person. There's a way to talk to an alcoholic, a way to talk to a cocaine addict, a way to talk to a meth addict, heroin addicts, whoever, medication addicts. There are ways to talk to those people so they listen, and there's ways to wait for the moment of openness, which dependably happens for all those people, but does not happen for the marijuana user. The marijuana user lives in a universe where what they're doing has no downside. It's all good. It's herbal. It's safe. Everybody should do it. It's better than being drunk or high in other ways. And there's this kind of cultural endorsement of marijuana that doesn't exist with other substances. But it's like all the other substances. And it has a unique effect. Marijuana does 2 things that are different. One is it creates an artificial self. And among the stoners that you know, you see this every day. They're friendly, helpful, relaxed, creative, spontaneous people who are going nowhere. And they're not getting angry, and they're not doing anything really in much. The self-regulation that they would otherwise have to exert to just get through a regular day of driving in traffic and other such things, all of that is managed by the substance. So they go through in this kind of fog of ease, relaxation and ease. And increasingly, that artificial self, the cultivation of self-regulation through the artificial means, becomes a new personality, kind of, which is which lies on top of the existing personality. And they just kind of float along in this way. So they get stuck. And marijuana damages your brain in the same way that other substances do over time with regular use. But it has a unique way of damaging your brain. Alcoholics have brain damage around spatial dynamics. Like they forget where they parked their car, for example. Cocaine users have brain damage around impulse control. They have real difficulty not getting mad and it being explosive, even years after they've stopped using. Marijuana users are damaged in the part of the nervous system in the brain that would allow them to notice that they're damaged, which is really interesting. And that's why when you talk to marijuana users, they never, no matter how stoned out they are, they never notice that this is having an effect on them. They don't see it. It's not denial. It's deeper than denial. It's brain damage. And so we have all these people now who are walking around kind of relaxed and easygoing and getting lattes on Commercial Drive. And they're not going anywhere. And the artificial self that marijuana creates, that regular marijuana use creates, has no interest in bootstrapping your life and doing interesting things. So you just float. And there's all these young people who are just floating through their 20s because of that, and their 30s. And those of us who are in their 40s and 50s, who've been regular marijuana smokers, if you're one of these people, you know people like this, who've been regular marijuana smokers for 20, 30 years, they already have that brain damage, which is, if they've been smoking a long time, it's probably a little subtle because the older marijuana is not as powerful as the new marijuana. But they've got this kind of brain damage going on where they don't notice any kind of impairment, but everybody else does. And the final thing about marijuana is that the marijuana user is the only one who will walk from relationships. If you take your average alcoholic or heroin addict and you have a loved one and the loved one reaches this moment where they can't stand it anymore and they say, you know, your addiction is destroying our relationship. I love you and I don't know what else to do. I'm desperate. You know, you need to fix this. And if you don't fix this, I'm out of here. I'm leaving. They'll stop. They'll say, whoa, okay. I'll get into recovery. I'll stop drinking. I'll do whatever. They won't actually do it, but they'll say they're going to do it. They can be brought to the table. They realize that intimacy is important. Love of people is important. When this happens with the marijuana user, person says, I love you, but you're this different person now, and you're just using all the time. You seem to be kind of drifting through your life, and I don't really recognize where the real you is underneath all this kind of stoner, relaxed self. Person says, well, if you can't handle it, then you must be the one with the problem. And they just walk. Nobody else does that. So it's a very troubling addiction for which we don't yet have a sufficiently robust cultural conversation about harm and risk. We do with alcohol, with crack cocaine, with heroin, with OxyContin, with fentanyl, whatever. We have this robust conversation about this stuff is crazy bad for you and could kill you. Not for marijuana. Nothing. Zilch. Except for, let's just make it all legal and put as many dispensaries around as we possibly can. And hey, Bob's your uncle. This is a bad idea. Okay, what else about tech or childhood development? Oh, yeah, that's a great question. Okay, so starting as early as you can, find the other families that have shared values around healthy technology use. So that by the time your kids get to 11, 12, 13, you have a small group of kids who are doing something else. By the time you get to 15, that's when you need it. You need to have a small group of peers who are not tech addicts, who don't just spend all their time gaming on the weekends. They find other things to do out in nature, out in the world with mentors. That works in the same way that if you want to avoid the addiction and substance use problem in high school with your kids, that's what you do. The majority of young people in high school do not want to go to parties on the weekend in grade 9 and get drunk and get high. They don't want to do that. Majority of kids report they don't want to do that. But that's where all the kids go. They go to these parties starting in grade 9. And then parents think that it's a good idea to sponsor these parties under the mistaken idea that if the kids are going to drink anyway, and it's better to have them safe in our home drinking with me supplying the booze so that they're not out in the, God knows where, doing something crazy and getting drunk. Don't do that. This is a bad idea. Kids whose parents facilitate drinking for them when they're underage have a much greater risk of developing a substance abuse problem as adults than kids who don't have this experience. So what you want instead is you want to find a small group of kids who do something else. Same with tech. Start as early as you can to cultivate a small group of kids who do something else, and with a mentor, ideally, and this is deeply protective. I don't usually like to talk about my kids in these presentations, but that example brings to mind. My son is a climber, rock climber. He teaches rock climbing. And he started climbing when he was 12 as a way to compete against his crazy academically proficient sister. And he got involved in the climbing community and climbing indoors and then outdoors and then teaching climbing and then teaching lead climbing and then this whole world of other kids who don't want to get drunk and high on the weekend and don't want to game their life away. They want to do interesting stuff inside and outside. So there's this whole community of climbing people who do that. And that's true for every kind of activity as well. Okay, question. No, yeah, the mentor needs to have specific skills, which most people don't have. Most people in a friendship kind of setting, they have the tendency in trying to help people through stressful situations, they have a tendency to give too much advice. They have a tendency not to listen effectively. They have a tendency to kind of tune people out after a while. The mentor needs a specific set of skills that are founded on empathic listening. Being attentive to what kids say is going on in their emotional life. And then asking, as step two, how can we deal with this? How can we help kids develop a set of activities or find a group or join our group in such a way that they get their emotional needs met? So it's a very deep study, and I know that there are people in the community who seem to naturally pick up these skills, just like in teaching, in the educational system. There are great teachers. But the teachers who are great teachers did not learn to be that way by going to teacher school. They learned to be that way by loving working with kids. Same thing with mentors. The great mentors are the ones who recognize the fundamental importance of mentorship in the life of young people. And the evolutionary heritage that comes from, by the way, this has been demonstrated. So, if you're a woman and you have daughters, you're getting older, they're getting older, the age at which your youngest daughter or your only daughter enters menopause, you're there, they're there, you're here in age, the age at which your daughter or youngest daughter enters menopause is the age at which you are more likely to die within the next 5 years, than at times after that. So, you don't have to die within 5 years of your daughter entering menopause. But you are more likely to. Because it seems like old people recognize that part of their fundamental role in our society is to help with grandkids, to mentor them. And when there's no longer any possibility of there being any grandkids, i.e. youngest daughter enters menopause, then they're kind of like, yeah, I'm done. And they go. So this is built into us. So one thing you can do is you can help kids forge deeper bonds with their grandparents, provided that works for them, provided the grandparents aren't too weird. which many seem to be. Okay. So, last question. Well, it was a different name games a few years ago, but I take your point. Yeah. I would say the principle stays the same, which is we should ask ourselves, what is the emotional benefit kids get from these games? And in that case, it's collaboration and creativity, leadership, play, and purpose. And those things are real. We shouldn't discount them just because they happen online. But we should also ask ourselves, how could we migrate some of that experience and find ways to replicate it in the real world? Because it's replicating play, collaboration, leadership, creativity, joy, whatever, in the real world that will lead to this movement out into adulthood. What's happening for a lot of young people, especially young men now, is they're creating these robust relationships online, but they're not able to translate that into the same kind of thing in the real world when they get to age 20. So that's a real problem. So we need to start to siphon off or migrate a little bit of that into real world activities that provide the same depth and quality of emotional interaction, but in the real world space, not the digital space. Okay. We're coming up to 8:30. So my last suggestion to you is that you just keep going. That you try a few things, see what happens. If you get stuck, or if there's a question that you didn't get answered tonight, feel free to follow up with me. You can find me there. I'm happy to get an email from you and answer your questions if you have them. I hope you learned something tonight and you found it useful. Thanks for hanging out.